Heart and ring.
It's been let loose, but wearing thin, wearing thin, but biting through the shifting power leans to you, and the cord is.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 10:59 a.m. and 45 seconds. Up next is the Health and Healthcare Forum. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your generous support for KBOO.
In 1964, a handful of determined classical music and jazz enthusiasts put their passion and engineering skills together to create Portland, Oregon's first community radio station. 4 years later, in 1968, KBOO was born. After 48 years, KBOO Community Radio is still very much a thriving media hub for Portland and beyond. 2018 will mark 50 years, and KBOO is planning a long line of celebrations now. We need your help. Our top four goals to get started are fundraising, Oregon Historical Society exhibit building, sharing stories in history, and events in celebration. For more information, contact volunteer at kboo.org or Armando Gonzalez at mandosmundo@yahoo.com. We look forward to your help.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring. We are seeking a full-time AM News and Public Affairs Director. Applications are due by 4 p.m. Friday, September 2nd at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Applications may also be emailed. Send them to hiring@kboo.org. To apply, please send both a resume and a cover letter outlining your skills and experience with regard to the minimum qualifications. And please answer the question, why is KBOO important? For more information and a full job description, go to kboo.fm/AM News. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Again, that's kboo.fm/AM News. And thank you.
Welcome to the Health and Healthcare Forum. I'm Roberta Hall. In these programs, we present new information or new insights about old and new health issues. We consider everything from community efforts to improve and extend healthcare to all people, to environmental issues that threaten us all, and to discussions with those individuals and their ideas that can move us forward in the search for health. City Club of Portland and the Oregon Chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program teamed up on August 1st to present a panel discussion concerning healthcare reform. The venue was changed twice to accommodate the large number of people, about 400, who said they wanted to attend. The meeting took place at the First Congregational Church of Portland. Mike Marshall, executive director of the City Club, introduced the panel of three distinguished doctors: John Kitzhaber, known for reorganizing Oregon's Medicaid program, producing the Oregon Health Plan while serving as a state senator and a governor; Donald Berwick, former administrator of the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services; and Alicia Moreland Capullo, executive director of the Avil Gordley Center for Healing at Oregon Health Sciences University; Dr. Paul Gorman, assistant dean for rural medical education at OHSU, moderated. Panelists were directed to speak about four topics: goals for health care reform, achievements of past reforms, shortcomings left over from past attempts at reform, and next steps. All spoke about their own views, not those of present or past employers, but clearly their work experiences informed their comments. I thank Metro East Community Media for sharing the audio of the video recording that it made at the event, and Portland City Club, Dr. Sam Metz of Oregon Physicians for National Health Program, and the participants. The full video will be available through the website for Oregon Physicians for National Health Program. I talked with Representative Mitch Greenlick, chair of the Healthcare Committee of the Oregon House of Representatives, before the event began. Representative Greenlick, Mitch, tell us why you came to this forum.
I came because I wanted to see my old friends, John Kitzhaber and Don Brewer.
All right, and they're going to be talking about something that's dear to your heart as chair of the Healthcare Committee in the House in Oregon. What do you expect them to say?
Well, I expect them to give us a little guidepost to how we can move to the future. I think they're two of the brightest healthcare minds on the earth, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what they have to say.
And I know one thing you're hoping for this year is some greater control on the CCOs, but that may not be what they're talking about. We don't know, do we?
No, I'm not sure what they're going to be talking about. I expect they'll be taking a broader perspective than that, but I do hope to have a chance to help redefine the CCOs as they move into the next five-year contract.
Sounds very good. Well, thank you very much for talking with KBOO.
Nice to talk to you.
I also spoke briefly with Bud Laurent, former chair of Mid-Valley Healthcare Advocates. I'm talking to Bud Laurent, and I'm just wondering why he came.
Well, it's a pleasure to be asked the question. I'm here basically to hear the thinking of these panelists on healthcare today, and especially single payer. And in particular, I'm interested in hearing what our former governor, John Kitzhaber, thinks about single payer and whether he thinks the ball has been advanced down the field since he was playing on it.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We'll listen to parts of the program and have some commentary as well.
I'm the moderator, Paul Gorman. I work for Oregon Health Science University, but nothing I say should be construed as representing the university. I'm here on my own. My job as moderator is not to advocate, but to facilitate. We'll talk about four main issues. I've asked them to comment on goals, what we want to achieve with our healthcare system, prior reforms, to what degree have recent and less recent efforts at reform gotten us to those goals, shortcomings, to what degree have our previous efforts at reform fallen short? Have there been side effects? Have they backfired? And finally, fourth, next steps. Where do we go from here and how do we get there?
For answering this question,
goals, what we want to achieve with our healthcare system,
Dr. Moreland Kabuya, Alicia, went first, then Dr. Don Berwick, followed by Dr. John Kitzhaber.
I want to step back a little bit with the question. I think that there's a more fundamental philosophical question that has to be answered, and that is, do we, whoever the we is, believe that healthcare or access to it is a fundamental, inalienable right? That's the first question. If the answer to that question is yes, if we believe that healthcare and everyone's access to it is as fundamental and important as breathing and eating, then we've reached a point of convergence, and that's a good place to be. I also want to add that I think that if we also agree that our ability to get healthcare transformation and the system of healthcare improved, if we believe that it is inextricably linked to the strength of our economy, both now and moving forward, then we also are in a good place. So now to answer the question, what is required for the healthcare transformation system to be good and to be useful? It has to be, the system has to be affordable, it has to be accessible, and it has to be adequate. And I think that the questions that will come up moving forward is, okay, With the Affordable Care Act, we have increased accessibility. I think we still have challenges around the areas of adequacy and affordability. And I would even argue that there's still some question about that accessibility. We've improved accessibility, but there is still yet more room for improvement. And I would also go back to where we started, this discussion of universal health care. The question is, in order for us to have universal health care, everybody must have health care. And not everyone has it yet, so we haven't quite yet achieved that. But if we go all the way back to Franklin Roosevelt in 1934, I'm also on the Oregon Historical Society, so I'm going to give a little bit of a history lesson. 1934, when Franklin Roosevelt, pushing forth his Social Security legislation, made mention of universal health care or national health care system, and boy, he was shot down. Actually, the Joint Ways and Means Committee came back to him and said, you've got to strike this or else you're not going to move things forward. So that was cast down. It was not popular. And then you move to 1947, when you have Harry Truman, who also at the time had Congress who was poised to move with him in this idea, right, in this philosophy of everybody who has a body deserves health care coverage. The American Medical Association actually was very good in helping unseat many of those Congress members and said, no, we're not ready for that conversation right now. And then we move forward to 1965, where we then get the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid under the direction of Lyndon B. Johnson. And that was really important legislation because it then took a subset of a population, both the elderly and the poor, and said, we're going to take care of them in a meaningful way and coordinate their efforts and control costs and improve quality of care for them. And that's questionable as well. But then we skip forward to the 90s, and then the 90s is where President Clinton at the time had wonderful ideas about healthcare transformation, but it was too complicated, and it wasn't communicated very well. So there's that national story in the 90s, and then we've got our Oregon story, which I'll let John talk about. But at the time, Oregon was leading in that effort. We had the Oregon Health Plan, which expanded the access to Medicaid coverage for the population, and it did fairly well. But again, there's this issue of cost and cost containment. Very good ideas, but how do we contain these? And then we fast forward to 2010 to the Patient Safety and Affordable Care Act, which accomplished probably as the single most powerful piece of legislation, comparatively speaking, to Lyndon B. Johnson's CMS development back in 1965, that moves us closer to this goal of universal health care, but it's near. We're almost there, but we haven't yet reached it. But the reason I wanted to take you through that kind of brief history lesson is because I believe that within our nation's history, there has always been the, sort of the subtext has always been everyone deserves health care as an American right. It's never been explicitly stated, but there has always been sort of this underlying desire, and it was demonstrated by Franklin Roosevelt back in the 30s and by Truman and then by Lyndon B. Johnson. There has been this desire. And now I think it's time for us to really act on it and to be intentional and to figure out how do we first get everyone covered. We cannot achieve universal health care unless everyone has access to it. Right now we don't have a health care system, we have a health care market. To conclude, in America right now, it's interesting, I want you to think about this. The condition is if you have a car in America, you're expected to have insurance, right? Now, where are our priorities? So you can speak to me. We're in a church, so you know we do call and response in church, right? So if you have a car, the expectation is that you have insurance. Well, if we applied that same logic, if you have a body, who in here does not have a body? Who in this world does not have a body? The same principle, if we applied it, if you have a body, then you should have insurance. So it goes back to, you could clap for that. Yeah, thank you. So it gets back to my original fundamental question, which is a philosophical one. Do we believe that healthcare is an inalienable right? And if we do, then I think we've got what we need in terms of moving us forward to move towards universal health coverage. Okay, thank you.
With Alicia's comment, all I can say is, wow. I mean, that was an eloquent and comprehensive statement. I agree with what you said. The way I would think about AIMS would be this. AIM 1 is the same as you said, which is healthcare is a human right and must be made so in the last developed nation on earth that has not yet done that. And it should be unequivocal and central. And one of the gaps I feel in public discourse is now that our leaders, both on the left and the right, are mincing words a little bit about that, and I just put my stake in the same ground as you did. That's the aim, one aim. Access to the properties of society, the enterprises that help you stay healthy should be a human right. Now, the next level down below that is the triple aim that colleagues of mine named John Whittington and Tom Nolan invented the notion in 2008. But John and Tom were asking a deeper question, which is, okay, if we're there to meet social needs, what's the need? That's just the first question anyone in my field of quality asks is, what need are we trying to meet? And they say, well, there's really three needs. One is that if you need care, it's going to be terrific. The best possible individual care, continually improving. You have a right to count on care the same way I have a right when I got on the Delta Airlines flight out here. I had a right to count on landing safely. We're nowhere near that. So one aim on that score would be, for almost every dimension, we should be aiming for like two orders of magnitude improvement. Right now, the injury rates for patients in hospitals are about 1 in 10. We shouldn't be satisfied with 1 in 1,000, but we should aim for it. The second of the triple aims is better health, because healthcare determines only 10% of your health. Your genes determine about 50%. 40% of your health is determined by things other than your care, like what you eat, your exercise, the environment, your race, your wealth, the presence or absence of poverty in the environment, violence on the streets. I think we need to reorient around a system that can actually help us stay healthy, and that's the second aim, and that's my vision. And we should regard the budget for pursuit of health as including pursuit of those properties. And then the last is cost. And here I have very strong feelings and probably too strong rhetoric, but I now know so much that I wish I didn't about the levels of waste in healthcare, about what the money we spend that doesn't help anyone at all because the system's set up the way you said, not logically. The waste levels are phenomenal, of the order of about a third of what we're spending. So we're getting to $3 trillion. So we're talking about $1 trillion a year that isn't helping anybody. The problem here is confiscation. The money comes from somewhere. It only comes from one place, whether that trillion of waste, it only comes from workers. There's no other source of the money that healthcare uses than labor. Think of it. If it goes through taxes, it's coming from taxpayers. If it's coming from employer insurance, it's alternative to wages. It's the only source. And that money has lots of other uses in the private sector, making your family well and thriving, in a company, competing in a global marketplace, and in government, building the housing we need, building the roads we should have, ending the criminal justice scandal in the country, working toward a just and equitable society. We need the money, and healthcare does not have a right to it. And so my vision is lower cost, because we don't have an entitlement to money that we're wasting. My target for the country, I think we should have a 15% of GDP target within the next 5 to 8 years. It would be a major dislocation in our economy, but one we need to swallow, because the positive benefit of that would be enormous.
I'm going to start out and then end with a somewhat controversial statement that maybe will stir up my other panelists here. So I think, obviously, if we want to be successful in terms of reform, we need to agree on what our objective is. So one of the fundamental questions to me is whether our objective is to finance and deliver medical care, or whether our objective is to keep people healthy. And if we can agree that the purpose of the healthcare system is health, not simply financing and delivering medical care, then there are a couple other things we need to realize. The first one is that healthcare is not necessarily synonymous with health, although we have a system that believes that. Healthcare is a means to an end, not an end in itself. I don't know anyone who wants attenuated flu virus squirted into their arm. They just don't want to get the flu. So healthcare has no intrinsic value outside its relationship to a positive health outcome, except as an economic commodity, which is largely what it's treated as today in the healthcare market. So that's point one. Point two is that when you look at those things that have the biggest impact on your lifetime health status, health care is not very important. It's like 20% maybe. 30% is genetics, and the other half are socioeconomic issues, whether you have an education, a job, your income, whether you have social supports and stable families, lifestyle and behavioral issues, whether you eat right, whether you exercise, whether you smoke, whether you take care of yourself, and the ability to make responsible lifestyle choices is also impacted by people's socioeconomic status, and environmental factors, the safety of your community, whether you have good housing. So my point is that if we focus this reform effort just on giving people access to health care and ignore the social determinants of health, which are far more important in improving the health of our society, we're not going to get from here to there. So I would say that the objective would be universal access, and access is different than coverage. Coverage deals with the financial barrier to access, but there are other barriers. There are language barriers, cultural barriers, transportation barriers. There are barriers in rural parts of the state because we don't have adequate providers There are barriers. If you're working a minimum wage job and your doctor's office is open from 8 to 5 and you're working 8 to 5, you have to take a day off and you can't afford to do it because you can't lose that income. So universal access to a defined set of effective health services that are linked to positive health outcomes and universal access to those social supports and economic opportunities that are critical to improve the health of individuals and of communities. I just want to make one comment on the healthcare as an inalienable right. And I believe that, but I would phrase it differently because I think phrasing it like that narrows the scope of the conversation. I think it would be more appropriate to say everyone in America should have an equal opportunity to be healthy. Now, what does that mean? That implies that everyone should have the right to a certain package of effective health services. I mean, why should someone have a right to services that are not effective? Why should someone have a right to determine the sex of their unborn child with an ultrasound when the only diagnosis is curiosity? Why should someone be able to destroy their own bodies and then expect the healthcare system to come in and rescue them? Universal access to a defined set of effective health services, but it also implies that we have an inalienable right to good housing, to good nutrition, to economic opportunity, to child care, to early learning, to education. We leave that out of our definition and focus just on giving people access to health care. I think we missed the ball game. And finally, it implies that everyone has a certain individual responsibility to do the very best they can to make the kinds of choices and decisions that will help preserve their own health without having to get involved in the medical system.
All three panelists had weighed in on the topic and then began a general discussion. Dr. Berwick started and was followed by Dr. Moreland Kabuya and summed up by the moderator, Dr. Paul Gorman.
You know, let's take a minute with this and explore the implications of what John's saying, because we agree. There's a virus just appeared, and if it infects a child, it has devastating consequences. It will cause, I think it's a sevenfold increase in school failure. It'll increase healthcare consumption costs by about fourfold. And I think it increases imprisonment by about sixfold. Would you vote for a vaccine to stop that virus as part of a health benefit package? Raise your hand if yes. But I made a mistake. It's not a virus. It's adverse child experiences, the ACEs score. And an ACEs score over 4 in a child has the, I think the statistics are about correct. And yet, what do we put into the outreach to the causes of toxic stress in children seeing the violence on their streets? Look at the list of what's on the ACEs score. We don't have a way to take our capital and move it from the ineffective care that's rampant and which people make a lot of money into fighting that outbreak.
So I work at the community level. I work with a large reentry population of folks dually diagnosed. These are patients who have been in jail, who have a mental health diagnosis, who also have substance use issues, and who struggle with houselessness. So it is a trifecta of comorbidities, okay? And one of the main things that I see from the ground level is that when folks don't have at least access to health care insurance, they cannot get access to the services that they need. And this is my fundamental point. We are not disagreeing, and it's not limiting the conversation. It's the first step, in my mind, to the conversation. When you're dealing with folks in front of you who have a very immediate need, and they don't have Medicaid coverage because they just came out of jail and they lost it because they went into jail, we have a problem, John. And so I'm saying access has to be the beginning. I didn't say it was the end. You added that part. But it definitely has to be the beginning of the discussion. And so I just wanted to make sure that I'm very clear, but I also like to have a good, healthy, hearty debate.
In terms of goals, I heard affordable, accessible, adequate, universal. I heard talk about social determinants that need to be addressed. Those are the main points I heard. If those are the goals, and we agree on them, and the one thing I heard across the board was human right. We have a right to this thing. We disagreed a little bit about what the thing is, but we have a right to it. So now, there have been reforms, just in my brief and checkered career, since DRGs in 1981, which was an incentivization of hospitals to reduce costs, to the ACA in 2010, we've had a series of reform efforts at the national and local level. And I wonder how well you believe those reforms have gotten us where we need to be. Let's start this time with Don.
Well, let's start with the good news. Affordable Care Act, which I was responsible for implementing about 70% of the provisions during the time I was in CMS, I give it a pretty high score. compared to the status quo. The numbers are important. And as it is written, the Affordable Care Act, if fully implemented, would have covered about 32 million people of the 50 million who don't have insurance in our country. Because the Supreme Court watered down the Medicaid expansion, preventing the government from enforcing Medicaid expansion on states, that left 19 states out of expansion so far. And through a number of other provisions, unfortunately traceable to the court in some significant measure, we're at only 20 million. That's about half the population of England. I mean, it's not bad. We've got half a country covered, four times the population of Scotland, who didn't have insurance before that. So, I mean, I think we should be having throwing a bit of a party on that one, that there's a lot of your neighbors who have coverage that didn't have it before. Kids under 26 covered under the parents' policies, forbidding insurance companies from failing to issue policies due to pre-existing conditions, that's gone. Lifetime limits on coverage are gone. A lot of enrichment of the benefit structure. In Medicare, for example, you may not know this, but when the 1965 law was passed, Medicare was only a hospital coverage system. Was not for prevention, was specifically not included in Medicare. Now it is. The Affordable Care Act added very strong prevention benefits, first dollar coverage. So I think as a step toward universality and human rights, pretty good. There are some provisions on transparency that are helping. And a sleeper that I don't know if you all know about, but it's this innovation center that I got to set up, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, CMMI, which has $10 billion over 10 years to invest in experiments. The reason we were able to get support to Oregon is because Oregon was proposing under John a very exciting new way to think about healthcare delivery, and the Affordable Care Act gave us the leverage to be able to say, okay, we want experiments like that that will achieve the triple aim. So that's all to the good. There's bad news.
You know what? Let's go ahead and mix them up for time.
All right. Very quickly. Here, there are really big gaps, though, and let me just—I'll recite them. I won't. We have 50 million uncovered. We covered 20 million. There's 30 million. They're there. They're human beings. They're people in Medicaid non-expansion states. They're people who haven't yet found their way onto the exchanges. They're undocumented residents here, aliens who live here, human beings, and civilized society should be making sure they have health care. They need it. It's a disadvantage to us to keep it from them. So there's pretty big excluded groups in our country right now. And how about rate of no coverage should be zero in America, not 30 million people. The Affordable Care Act is a compromise. You know, we kept the private insurance system. The Affordable Care Act was a way to use the private insurance system through exchanges to cover a lot of those 20 million, 30 million people. And there was a bit of a buy-off going on. So insurance companies have done very well, thank you. They'll complain in some markets, and there's problems with some subgroups. But overall, just look at the stock market. Just watch what these insurers have done. For example, Medicare Advantage was supposed to have cost reduction in the Affordable Care Act. Instead, every year Congress has given Medicare Advantage more money, in direct contradiction to the law. So the power of the insurance lobby is phenomenal. With respect to investments in prevention, they've proved quite vulnerable. We do have some good prevention work going on, but the first thing Congress did when the law was passed was take a big swipe at the prevention fund that was set up under CDC. I think it got halved or was closed. They were aiming for that. They would have zeroed it out if they could. Transparency has been incomplete, and we can't function without knowledge. Not for blame, not for reprisal, but would you drive your car at night without headlights? If we don't have the data on how things are going, we can't do very well. And just read the papers. I can get into the details here and bore the heck out of you, but we are too uncommitted yet to transparency. And finally, everything around social determinants, still only quarter of a loaf, not even half a loaf. We have not become a country invested in interrupting the generators of ill health. So we have a lot of work left to do.
Okay, thanks. John?
They haven't got us where we want to go, but they've definitely moved us quite a ways in the right directions. I'll go all the way back to 1989 when we enacted the Oregon Health Plan. The objective there really was to try to develop a floor, make a command decision about those people who couldn't afford the cost of their own health care to make sure that they were covered with public dollars. And in 1989, we passed a law that said anyone who had an income up to 100% of the federal poverty level should be eligible for Medicaid, and they didn't have to fit in one of the federal categories, which is essentially what the ACA did 22 years later, but it went up to 138%. And the second thing we did was recognize that healthcare is not necessarily synonymous health and build a benefit based on a priority list that tried to connect health services to their value in improving the health of the entire population being served. So we were ahead of our time in a couple of ways. What it didn't do is it didn't try to demand outcomes and quality. It was more of a benefit design coverage exercise. But millions of Americans have benefited from that. Millions of people have benefited from that since it was implemented in 1994. Then 2011, the coordinated care organizations, I think, have also been tremendously successful. They were based on the premise that we should refocus on community and population health, that we should operate under a global budget that grows at a fixed amount per year. So they grow at 3.4% per member per month. They can't exceed that. That they have to have very strict outcome and quality metrics. That they ought to be able to use federal dollars to spend on things that aren't traditionally considered healthcare, but actually improve health, like community health workers, for example, or maybe housing. Finally, we push the accountability for health and cost to the local level. We have 1.1 million people in that model today. They're all operating within their fiscal constraints, and they're turning in remarkable health outcomes, reduction in ED visits, reduction in hospital rehospitalizations for congestive heart failure and asthma. A lot of more kids are getting developmental assessments before the age of three, and the list goes on. So that's been very, very successful, and I think the ACA pushed a lot more people into that care model. We've reduced the number of people without insurance in Oregon from 14% down to less than 5%, and as Don said, 20 million Americans today have health insurance coverage that they didn't have on January 1st, 2014, and that really is a huge, huge accomplishment that we should certainly celebrate. I think the problem is that there are still gaps. Some of the people that have insurance are experiencing a huge increase in deductibles, which are going up 4 or 5 or 6 times faster than wages. So many people who are insured, for all practical purposes, aren't. I think we need to do coverage and delivery reform simultaneously, not sequentially, because even if you have everybody covered, unless you address the fundamentally perverse incentives in the delivery system, you can't control cost or improve quality, right? And unless you take that on, it doesn't matter whether you have a single payer system or private commercial insurance or Medicare and Medicaid, you're paying for the same inefficient, hyperinflationary, ineffective healthcare system. So I would just say that we need to redouble our efforts to get everybody under the tent, but at the same time, to keep them under the tent, we've got to take on delivery system reform.
You are listening to excerpts from a program on healthcare reform. There are several panelists, John Kitzhaber, Donald Berwick, and Alicia Moreland Capuya. Paul Gorman is moderator. The program was presented August 1 by the City Club of Portland and the Oregon Chapter of Physicians for a National Health Program.
So I think that we've made some tremendous strides. The Affordable Care Act did a very nice job of offering a public option. And that public option then sort of help the market, right? Because you've got private insurers who have their costs set. When you saturate the market, you create competition, you force people to have to lower their prices. And it also expanded what I think all Americans love is this idea of choice. I started at the beginning talking about in order for healthcare to be useful, it has to be affordable, it has to be accessible, and it has to be adequate. So it doesn't ignore these other components. In order for it to be adequate, what we're dealing with is the quality aspect of it. You should be able to get the right care at the right time by the right person every time. That is the goal. We have not reached that. There are many gaps. It should be affordable in terms of cost. There are a number of folks who have insurance but cannot afford the deductibles, or even in some cases, they are cut off with how many visits they can see a certain specialty doctor. And then that gets to the adequacy question. So there are still very many gaps. And we haven't really talked about all of the things that have driven some of the high cost. We are a free society. Technology has been super important in how we do business. It has become a prominent centerpiece and feature in much of the healthcare. And some would argue that the information technology, IS world, and the advance of technology has increased costs in a way that is problematic. There's a book by Tom Daschle, basically had this pyramid, and the pyramid had primary care at the bottom as the foundation and specialty care at the acme or at the peak of this pyramid. And then he compared on two sides, he compared the United States of America to other countries. And he said that other countries understand fundamentally that primary care should be the base and the point at which we all operate from. Everyone should be able to go see a primary care doctor and get preventative care services. And then if they need specialty care to get it, and he also added technology at the top with the specialty care. But then he showed the United States of America. It started from the top to the bottom so that we are really in reverse, inappropriate order, where right now, if you needed to see a cardiologist, you could probably get in to see a cardiologist before your primary care provider. And that's because we've got a workforce issue. We've got a demand, a supply and a demand issue. So there are a number of things that I feel like still need to be resolved, right? So there's accessibility, but there's still many areas in this around affordability and around adequacy. And I would also say accessibility. We keep saying healthcare system. I'm not really convinced that it's a system. We have a healthcare market. And in a market, there's a very clear top and a very clear bottom. And in a market, there are certain people who get to access that market more readily and more robustly than others. And I think that if equity is the goal and equal access is really the chief universal goal, then we've still got a lot of work to do in that area. But the Affordable Care Act was a nice, rich, forceful next step in helping us to achieve that.
So now then, moderator asked them to talk about potential side effects from those reforms, mainly the negative ones.
When you think about the reform efforts that we've had, have we seen side effects? Have we seen inadvertent adverse effects of the healthcare reforms that we've tried to implement?
I can give you one. This is not a systemic problem, but when the Medicare Modernization Act was passed in 2003, which added a prescription drug benefit to Medicare, the drug industry was able to insert into that bill language that prohibits Medicare from negotiating prices with the drug company, something every private sector company does. And if you add up Medicare and Medicaid, you have a huge number of people that you could use to drive down pharmaceutical costs. That has got to be fixed, to be very short here, but I was looking today at the stock health of Gilead, which is a company that produces a hepatitis C drug, which is marvelous because it can cure hepatitis C at the cost of $90,000 for a course of treatment and maybe a second course of treatment. This year, they are supposed to make somewhere around $17 billion in cash flow. And I could be off $2 billion up or down, but that's in the ballpark. They're spending 20% of that on R&D and, get this, 45% buying back their own shares to increase the value per share and give a bigger return to their stockholders. That is obscene. And that needs to be called out. And I think whoever is elected president, priority really needs to be made on getting that language out and using the purchasing power of the public sector to drive down those costs.
Any unexpected adverse effects from your point of view, Don?
Well, we can start with the pharmaceuticals. We're out of control now. It's not just the specialty drugs. The prices of insulin have risen not just year on year, even within years. So have insulin strips. The pharmaceutical industry is now in a spiral of increase that I don't think we've ever witnessed before, and there's no control of that yet. I don't think we can sit there that much longer on this. It's denying people access to meds they need, and since so much pharmaceutical purchases involves copayment, as I said, pushing back on the insurance industry, the Medicare Advantage story. This is controversial, but I really think Medicare Advantage should have been pressed down to the ordinary Medicare levels or lower. After all, it's supposed to be well-managed care, and instead the opposite's been happening, and I think that was the consequence of the politics of the Affordable Care Act, maybe not unanticipated, but certainly unwanted. Delivery system reform, it's sort of simple. It's like the care you need to help you stay healthy if you're well, to enjoy your life if you have a chronic illness. You could describe it. It's not so hard to describe. You probably want a team involved. You want respect for your own preferences. You want the use of the community resources that you're linked to as part of the whole picture. If you have mental health issues, you want to make sure those are incorporated into your plans. You could describe a kind of holistic, community-centered, home-based, respectful care. It's not what you have. We'll never get where we want without pushing hard on the delivery system change. And what we're assuming is the market can do that. If we set the contingency right, the market will surface. And I think there's a better way. The rest of the gaps are pretty technical. We didn't do anything on telemedicine. And I think that's a big, wonderful area where telemedicine and telehealth could create part of the future that we really want that's as easy to use as most of the rest of your life. Why is the electronic record not more like a cell phone? It's not in the law. We didn't do that. We're starting to fix it, but we got ways to go.
I just want to ask Dr. Marlene Capuia, what about you? Do you see any side effects, backfires?
I do, and from the ground level, I think it's really important. Again, it's an important discussion to have about the finance and the delivery, and I want to focus on the delivery end of it. You know, when the ACA was passed, there were these specific measures. The goal was for agencies to have an electronic health record because it will create greater efficiencies. And again, that makes sense, right? You would think. But here's how I want you to kind of think about it. So I eliminate the clerk in the front room who does the medical records, but then I've got to add two staff to my ITIS department to make sure that my EMR doesn't crash. So then you ask yourself the question, if I traded one for two, is that efficient? Is that efficient? I don't think so. Just basic sort of reasoning, right? Or we say, okay, it's going to be more efficient for us to make sure that we are coordinating our efforts, which is important. We've been giving a very important role for what integration should look like. And there are prerequisites to integration. And we say, okay, you psychiatrist and you primary care physician, you all need to be working together in one place at least. And then eventually find some time to get on the same shared medical record. And then eventually communicate enough with each other so that you don't have the patient coming to the same facility that you both work at three times during the week when they could be seen all in one day. If we had better coordinated that effort and if we had the systems and structures in place that would allow for reimbursement of services. I think we are moving in that direction with CMS, but we still have some challenges there. So I think that what we have seen is that I think that the intentions have been great. I think that it has capacity, this ACA has capacity to be wonderful, but there's a lot of fine-tuning, and the fine-tuning has to be considered at the patient level. Because the question is, how does it impact the patient? We can have all these wonderful policies and procedures and expectations for what the service or the delivery of service should be, but on the ground level, how does the policy play out? And there have been tremendous side effects. And the other issue that I want to highlight again is that we have folks, some of our most vulnerable folks that we're trying to serve and we're trying to get ahead of the curve and we're trying to keep them out of prison and we're trying to keep them out of the emergency departments and we're trying to get them to make more effective use of their primary care providers in their health homes. They slip up because that's a part of this relapse prevention and recovery process. They end up in jail. They don't have a house. So then they lose their coverage. It's hard for them to gain coverage when they get out. They don't know how to navigate a big wonky system that was meant and developed to help them. And then we end up with more situations of greater hospitalization. So I think that CCOs or the coordinated care organizations are islands of excellence. But what I would like to see is a nation of excellence. I think that we've got to think about not just the larger policy, but how it's impacting people on the ground level. And I think that I've seen the, you know, electronic medical health records are great, but they also cost a lot of money, and they also have a high administrative burden. The policy is great that you want coordinated care and for all, everyone to work with each other, but problem is there are a lot of systems barriers to that, namely around billing and serving people. So we've got a lot of work to do in that area.
I do think that state innovation is going to be the pathway. It's clear if we can demonstrate, you know, ways forward, that that's much more likely to be adopted by the states as well. So a couple of specific points, and then I'll make a broader statement about single payer. So I think that in Oregon in particular, we need to extend more aggressively and robustly that CCO care model into the private market, because this won't work unless we get it into the private market. We've done that a bit with Oregon Public Employees Benefit Board. We need to add the Oregon Education Benefit Board, so that's 300,000 people right there in the private market. And then we need to be able to list this option on the exchange as an option for employers. So that should be a high priority. Secondly, I think it's important that we prevent any more out-of-state for-profit companies from buying coordinated care organizations. The Centene purchase of Trillium down in Lane County shifts the focus from community-based care to feeding a shareholder out of Missouri, and that'll be the death knell to the coordinated care organization. So, you know, having said that, a lot of these CCOs were part of the IPAs that were created in the 90s to take care of the Oregon Health Plan, and those docs who made the initial investments were in their 40s and 50s, and now they're in their 60s and 70s, and CCOs are valuable assets. So we need to give them a way to get cashed out, but not a way that basically piecemeals our experiment out of state. I think it's really important that CCOs begin to evolve from a hospital physician-centric organization to one which has as a part of its business model the redeployment of resources upstream in the community to begin to address the social determinants of health. And let me say, aspirationally, I mean, I think you can get from here to there. We've come a long way since 1987 to 2012. I don't know how many of you remember the Archimedes movement. A few of you there. Well, what we were trying to do there was a design exercise that essentially identified all the public dollars we were spending on healthcare in the state of Oregon, Medicare, Medicaid, and the value of the tax deductible portion of your private insurance. And with that, we wanted to ask, okay, how could we create a floor for every last Oregonian? What would that benefit look like? And what would we have to do to the delivery system? And that one was snuffed when AARP came in and stepped on the air hose of the conversation because it involved Medicare. But I do think that the place we need to end up is a publicly financed floor, just like we do in public education. Every child, regardless of income, gets a public education. You can argue about whether it's a good education or not, but everyone is covered. And parents who want to give their kids more can use their after-tax dollars to get a tutor or send their kids to a private school. We need a publicly financed floor, a defined set of effective health services, and there's more than enough money in the system to allow everyone to have everything that could possibly benefit from them from a health care standpoint, with the ability of people who want to purchase more can do so with their after-tax dollars. So that's where we need to get. We're almost there with Medicare and Medicaid. We're moving in that direction with the aging of the baby boomers. So I think the question is, what's the strategic steps that you can take at the state level to begin to tee up that conversation more robustly as part of the national agenda?
Next steps, how do we get there?
The thing we talked about right at the beginning about setting aims and agreeing on them as a matter of social solidarity to me is key. And I think we need to be explicit, have the courage to be explicit. If we can't do that nationally, you should do it at the state level. But we articulated some of the dimensions. You don't know how to get there if you don't know where you're going. So the aims are key. With respect to the next couple of years, I do think pharmaceutical costs are an urgent fire. It's hurting people, and we need an aggressive, courageous stand on that, hopefully in some cooperation with the pharma industry if they'll go there, but this is not optional. We've got to fix this. Well, let's go to states. I felt in Washington, I feel here, that state experimentation is a real opportunity now, given especially Washington's relative paralysis. As you may know, I ran for governor in Massachusetts. I ran for the Democratic nomination. I'm not governor, so I lost. But I didn't start, but I ended up putting single payer in my platform. And I do think there should be some states that try single payer now if it's possible to have the architecture. We can get into the details, but I think we can have a mature public dialogue about the base that John's talking about. I think it would be far more efficient administratively. I think right off the top, there's probably double-digit percent of the total expend you get back because it's just a simpler system. So I really would like to see that somewhere. How about here? Short of that, as you know, Secretary Clinton's put a Medicare expansion on the table to offering it as a public option to people above 55 and older that failed in her 2003 try at reform, but the time may have come, and it's a step. Two other quick things I'll say. One is John's vision of these CCOs was world-leading, not just national-leading, and I think it's trying to get all of the resources in a pot for a population, and so some form of global budgeting in which you finally can say, I think I'll buy an air conditioner for that child with asthma, and it can happen, is a very important resorting of opportunity, and I would keep pushing that. If you can't do it with single payer, you can do it still by really digging in even further on this idea of globally budgeted population responsible groups, not for profit. You know, WHO has a brilliant set of guidance around what they call health in all policies, and we've talked a lot about social determinants, but this is not virgin territory. If we really want to start to think about every move we make on transportation policy, housing policy, education policy, criminal justice policy, as all related to building robust and vital communities, and if we have leadership, executive leadership and legislative leadership that really expects that, they want it to make sense, I think we can make some progress. So I'm looking for parts of the country that say we're going to take that global view, the generators of well-being, and make that the public policy.
The question was the next steps in terms of achieving universal health coverage. And I think it's inherent in the name, universal. In order for it to be universal, everyone has to have it, has to have insurance. And so that's the first place to start. We haven't reached that. The next steps is to at least ensure that everyone has health care coverage, not independent of these other psychosocial components that we've discussed here today, but parallel to. You know, it's interesting, Vermont came this close to coming towards a single-payer system, and then they recognized, oh, shoot, they didn't finish it, they didn't execute, because there was not a secure financial plan or financial basis to undergird the plans. I do believe a single-payer system is something that we should be working towards. I think we have to be mindful of how we do that. I think it also gets back to this very issue, and I want to go back to my beginning philosophical point, because there's an arc, a beginning, a middle, and an end, and I want to go back to the beginning as my end. In order to achieve this, everyone has to agree and have shared definitions and an understanding of what we are actually trying to achieve. If it's universal health care, then how we finance that is important. Us agreeing on the fact that it should be financed is key. And then how do we deliver it? Should it be private? Should it be a publicly funded endeavor through taxes, but then it's delivered through private entities? Is it not-for-profit organizations that do it? Is it for-profit? Those things are all up for discussion and should be discussed. But I think that a primary beginning first step is at least getting everyone covered. We do not have that now. So the next step, in my purview, is it's real simple and basic. Let's at least get everyone covered.
I think we're ready for questions. Okay, I'll read the question. What are Oregon's chances of qualifying for the Section 1332 innovation waiver under PPACA, the long version of ACA, and what is the likelihood of achieving renewal of the waiver every 5 years? What's this waiver? What's a 1332 waiver?
It's one of the waiver authorities, and Medicare can say the state can go ahead and try innovations. Figure out what you want and what it could deliver and promise that as part of what you're the offer to the federal government. Now, you know, the job of the Medicare trustee or the actuary or OMB is to make sure that money is being used as well as it possibly can. That's their job, and that's the scrutiny to which these waivers will be subjected, absent other political influences.
I think the answer also is yes, and I think it's really important for Oregon to continue to emphasize the amount of money that our last five-year waiver has saved not only the state but the federal government. It's a really big deal. It's over $4 billion of net savings to the federal government, and hundreds of millions of dollars that we didn't have to spend on health care that can be spent on education and a variety of other things. So it's important that we continue to articulate that this is not just a grab for more money, this is actually saving money and improving quality.
Yeah. So let me ask you all to comment on the connection between nutrition and health and the way we think about it.
Yeah, so a very good question. Your response about health being all-encompassing and more about wellness, that's the World Health Organization definition, and it's a nice, I think, working definition that many folks who are on the ground working in an integrated setting do believe. There are many practices that have integrated naturopaths and dietitians, osteopaths and allopaths, recognizing that who we are dealing with is a whole person, that the body is indeed connected to the head, and that those things are important. So definitely in my practice, we consider all of that, and wellness is it's a state of being. It is the ability to pursue happiness and to gain fulfillment in all the areas of your life around professionalism, relationships, spiritual fulfillment. It's all of the above. So definitely we take a holistic approach in the community settings in which I operate.
I would agree. I think the definition of health is overall well-being, not just the absence of disease. And actually, taken up just to the policy level, you know, part of our vision here in Oregon was not just the coordinated care organizations, but were the early learning hubs, which essentially were initially designed to make sure that kids were, you know, basically reading at level in third grade, which requires wraparound services, mental health services, family support services. I'll just conclude by saying I think this gets back to Don's point. At the end of the day, it's the community aspect of these things that is powerful, that we can set the high-level policy, but it's figuring out those ways of integration and engagement at the community level that's actually going to produce that kind of a definition of health.
Thanks, John. Don?
This harkens back to this health in all policies idea, which I think is a really, really powerful and important idea. It's not a throwaway. So for Oregon or for Bend or Portland or for a governor, I would say get everyone around the table and understand how it's all affecting this kit in terms of nutrition. Because it is transportation, it is housing, it's not going to be one thing. And I think thinking holistically is the challenge. It's the challenge of our era, really, instead of in fragments. Two other quick points. Underneath our conversation, I have a belief, which maybe John and Alicia will not endorse. I think a lot of this is about poverty. I mean, better off people, of course, have nutritional problems, but if you take any one of the risks we're talking about and you map it back, income inequality and poverty is a big root, I think, that a healthcare enterprise and advocates who mean it are going to have to be advocates for the relief and elimination of poverty.
And now, as editor and producer of this program, I'm going to have just a few words of commentary. This has been a discussion of healthcare reform with three panelist doctors, Dr. John Kitzhaber, Dr. Don Berwick, Dr. Alicia Moreland-Kabuya, and it's been moderated by Paul Gorman. At several points during the discussions, the doctors brought up the issue of primary care. All favored putting much more emphasis on primary care and less on specialists, and talked about in a universal system who all might serve as primary care providers. Suggested were naturopaths, chiropractors, nurse practitioners, and it was also suggested the use of more dietitians and nutritionists and others to help the primary care people do their job. They all agreed a stronger wellness program is needed. To the extent that there were disagreements, I challenge you to remember that they sometimes seem to be talking about the topics from entirely different perspectives. But in listening twice to this, I found they really share the same overall goal: a society with fewer disparities in income, a society where everyone has a healthy environment, good food, and access to health care. I thank Dr. Sam Metz of Oregon Physicians for a National Health Program, the City Club of Portland, and Metro East Community Media for access to this program. The Health and Healthcare Forum is produced by Roberta Hall. Theme music was composed by Laurie Childers and played by Laurie Childers and Kent White.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is the news at noon.
And now the KBOO News at noon for Monday, August 29th, 2016. In local news, a coalition of Portland Harbor companies have announced plans to challenge the City of Portland's decision to place a homeless shelter in the Terminal 1 building on Northwest Front Avenue. On August 2nd of this year, the Portland City Council approved a plan to operate a temporary 18-month homeless shelter at the city-owned 14-acre Terminal 1 port site. The council approved the plan on a 3-2 vote, and Nick Fish, the commissioner who oversees the bureau, which owns the building, has stated he doesn't believe the lease will hold up to legal challenges, saying it violates the bureau's own regulations and the recently adopted comprehensive plan. The challenge to the proposed homeless shelter is the second to be publicly announced and joins a suit filed by an attorney representing several Portland Water Bureau ratepayers who claim the lease is well under market value and hence illegal. In more local news, tensions are building as the City of Portland continues with its plan to close the Springwater corridor of homeless campers beginning this Thursday. There are believed to be more than 250 people still living in the corridor located in southeast Portland, and dozens of the homeless campers are objecting to the planned eviction, saying they have nowhere else to go. Several Lentz neighborhood residents and area restaurants are also protesting the city's decision, claiming it will force the homeless into area neighborhoods which are unprepared for the influx. Several weeks ago, city officials posted more than 1,000 notices on tents and living areas in the Springwater corridor and now believe that up to 75% have already vacated the area. In national news, a newly issued summary report released by the United States Geological Survey states that grizzly bear deaths in the Yellowstone area have hit an unsustainable level. It is estimated that 85 grizzlies out of the 717 currently living in the Greater Yellowstone ecosystem died in 2015. The number of deaths was the most since record keeping began in 1959 and was a 20% increase over the previous year. 25 out of the 85 grizzly deaths were reproductive-aged females, which are seen as an indicator of species health. Government Endangered Species Act protocols state that any number greater than 18 reproductive age female deaths per year would cause a decline in the overall bear population. Of the 85 deaths, at least 19 are being actively investigated as poaching incidents. Despite the high mortality rate, the U.S. Department of Fish and Wildlife is continuing to develop a plan to delist the Yellowstone grizzly as an endangered species, an act that would allow sport hunting of the grizzly bear. In more national news, Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton has issued an executive order limiting the use of neonicotinoid-based insecticides, believed to be a prime cause of the honeybee colony collapse disorder, wreaking havoc upon the nation's honeybee populations. The executive order was based upon a three-year review of the impacts of neonicotinoid insecticides on pollinators conducted by the Minnesota Department of Agriculture. The new law will limit the use of neonicotinoids by requiring that agricultural users provide verification as to why no other insecticide would work. The new law, while the strongest in the nation, does not cover seed coatings, although the governor has called on the Minnesota State Legislature to close the loophole. Nationally, 94% of all corn and up to 50% of all soy seeds are coated with neonicotinoid spray prior to planting. A recent U.S. Department of Agriculture report stated that up to 44% of all honeybee colonies have died in the last year. In international news, experts meeting at the annual International Geological Conference have voted unanimously to acknowledge that the Earth has officially entered a new geological epoch called the Anthropocene. Scientists say the new epoch actually began in the 1950s and is characterized by human activity changing global environmental systems. The experts point to industrialization, nuclear activity, human-caused global warming, and the proliferation of plastics as the prime culprits. The global physical traits that determine the new epoch include increased global levels of CO2 in the atmosphere, increased levels of nitrogen and phosphorus in the soil, and an up to 75% extinction rate in the next 100 years for all species currently living on the planet. The vote was the first step in a three-year process in the formal recognition of the Anthropocene epoch by the International Union of Geological Sciences. And that's all for the KBOO News at noon for Monday, August 29th, 2016. Tune in every weekday at 5 for more local, national, and international news produced by volunteer reporters in our Portland studios. For KBOO News, I'm Don Zer.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Curiosities, a vintage mall serving the West Side with space for over 70 dealers and a selection of vintage.